From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the unbearable sadness of a luxury cruise and other reflections on life's forced pleasures. Writer David Foster Wallace talks with us about his new collection of essays called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. His latest novel, Infinite Jest, has just been published in paperback. Also, The Diary of a Mod Housewife. We talk with singer-songwriter Amy Rigby. This 37-year-old mother sings about temp work, tired marriages, and getting older, while, she says, trying to keep a sense of humor about it all. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new Great Performances special on PBS, Ira Gershwin at 100. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has proposed new rules to make it tougher for foreigners to purchase guns, NPR's Chittaraghavan reports.
President Clinton said he's responding to the recent deadly shooting at the Empire State Building in New York by a Palestinian English teacher. The Palestinian shot seven tourists, killing one, and then shot himself. The man bought a 14-shot Beretta semi-automatic handgun in Florida after staying just 3 weeks in a motel there. Mr. Clinton said the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms will require gun buyers to certify that they've lived at least 90 days in the state where they want to buy guns, and it would require them to prove they are legal aliens. The president also signed a new directive that requires police officers and agents from every federal law enforcement agency to be issued with child safety locks with every handgun, and he wants Congress to pass a law requiring all guns sold to the public to be equipped with such child safety locks. I'm Chitraraghavan in Washington.
Residents of Midwestern states are preparing for more flooding. The Ohio River is expected to crest today more than 10 feet above flood stage in Cincinnati. Weather forecasters say the river will reach 13 feet above flood stage in Louisville, Kentucky. Thousands of people who live along the riverside are running for higher ground. Tennessee is getting much more rain now, and more flooding is expected there. It's not clear how much damage has been done, but it's estimated to be in the millions of dollars. The Palestinian Authority's Jerusalem representative, Faisal Husseini, has condemned Israel's decision to close down four offices at East Jerusalem, allegedly run by the Palestinian Authority. Lori Neff reports.
Israel says closing the Palestinian offices and Israel's plan to build a Jewish neighborhood in mainly Arab East Jerusalem only hurts the credibility of the Palestinian Authority and strengthens the hand of Palestinian fundamentalists and extremist groups.
If they will succeed in that, the Israeli government and the Palestinian card will fall down from the hand of the Palestinian secular leadership. The only one who will be able to pick it up is the fundamentalist.
Israel says Palestinian Authority operations in Jerusalem violate Israeli-Palestinian agreements. Israel hasn't said which offices it will close, but sources say Orient House, the Palestinians' unofficial Jerusalem headquarters, isn't on the list. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Jerusalem.
The president of Switzerland is suggesting a multi-billion-dollar fund be created for Holocaust victims. President Arnold Kahler told the Swiss parliament that proceeds for the $5 billion fund would come from gold reserves. His suggestion is seen as a victory for international groups that claim Swiss banks are still holding funds belonging to murdered Jews. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up more than 38 points at 68.90. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, American stocks are rising after some comments from Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. Bloomberg's Paul Lynn reports.
Greenspan made some remarks this morning ahead of his congressional testimony that gave investors some optimism. He said U.S. stocks are not necessarily overvalued. Some on Wall Street said it seemed the Fed chairman was backing down from his concerns about the stock market. They also say the jump in stocks this session shows investors are less concerned about Fed policymakers raising interest rates. Among the gainers, shares of rate-sensitive banks, which could suffer if the cost of borrowing rises. While stocks are mostly higher this session, there are a couple of big decliners. Shares of Corporate Express, the office products company, have plunged about 45% on a profit warning. Also, Broderbund software shares are down, again because of a profit warning. In the Treasury market, bond prices are little changed ahead of part two of Alan Greenspan's testimony before the House Banking Committee. This is Paul Lynn.
Hundreds of McDonald's franchise owners in New York are refusing to go along with the company's new marketing effort to cut the price of Big Mac sandwiches. The new price across the country is 55 cents, but the New York owners say because their area is so expensive, the sandwiches will only be offered at the cut rate during off-peak hours. Boeing Company says the global airline industry will buy 16,160 new planes over the next 20 years. That's 160 more planes than Boeing had earlier estimated. Boeing says single-aisle planes will be the most popular ones built, but twin-aisle aircraft requests are growing. Meanwhile, Boeing's also cut its forecast for the annual growth of world travel. Fewer people are expected to travel in the Asia-Pacific region. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve health and health care for all Americans.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Foster Wallace has a new collection of essays on subjects ranging from TV's overuse of self-consciously hip irony to competitive tennis, contemporary literature, and the difficulty of having a good time. Wallace was acclaimed as an important new voice when his first novel, Broom of the System, was published in 1986, when he was in his mid-20s. His latest novel, Infinite Jest, was described in Time magazine as a send-up of humanism at the end of its tether. The title essay in his new collection is called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. It's about the luxury cruise he was asked to write about for Harper's Magazine. The cruise ads promised exciting activities and entertainment to fill every moment of the day. He says it's as if they're trying to convince you that you are guaranteed of having a good time because the cruise personnel will micromanage every pleasure option, and your troublesome capacities for choice, error, regret, dissatisfaction, and despair will be removed from the equation.
Do you think that when people are on vacation, they worry that they're not making the right choice in what they're doing and they're not having as much time as they're supposed to be having or as much fun as other people on vacation are having? And then when you have the day managed for you, you can just relax because the professionals are handling it for you.
I think that's probably true, and I think that there's a weird kind of paradox that the more expensive the vacation is, the more potentially anxiety-producing it is. And that's why I think, you know, the paradox is that a great deal of the expense of a luxury cruise, other than the facilities, is this entire battalion of professional fund managers going around. And a big part of their job is to assure you that you're having a good time. And their smiles were very high watt, and they were constantly sort of inviting people up to the microphone to give sort of almost evangelical testimony to what a good time they were having.
You're right. There's something about a mass market luxury cruise that's unbearably sad. What's sad about it?
Oh, boy. I think, now again, I'm not any kind of cruiseologist, right? So I'm just a regular sort of civilian who is on this thing. I think that I notice the same kind of sadness whenever in my own life I know that there's hard stuff that I'm not dealing with. And so what happens is I'll jack it into fifth gear and begin moving so fast and doing so much and trying to experience so much that I'm really sort of trying to drown it out. I think the old-fashioned phrase for that is whistling in the graveyard. The weird thing about a cruise is you don't even have to do the work to do that. They'll do it for you. You're sort of paying for a week of having your consciousness obliterated, except for various nerve endings that are being stimulated pleasurably. Does that make any sense?
Yes, I think I know exactly what you mean, this whole idea of drowning out all the fears that you have. Sometimes that actually works to drown it out, and other times you're aware of all the effort that you're going through to drown it out, and that makes it very disconcerting.
It works for a while. What I really wanted, and Harper's didn't want to do it, was I really wanted to follow a couple cruisers back and see what the week after the cruise was like, because the brochures and the sort of mythology of cruising suggests that you return to the stresses of your normal life relaxed and refreshed. And at least in my own experience, the cruise was so completely infantilizing and there was so little demanded of me that even just, you know, standing in a supermarket checkout line seemed like an unendurable ordeal afterwards.
Well, I think that's so true of most vacations. You come back and it's just impossible to adapt to your working life again.
Yeah. I don't think that's the way it's supposed to be set up, though. I think it's supposed to be set up so life is this task and reward thing, and you task for 11 months and 3 weeks out of the year, and then that last week you're supposed to be able to kind of float in some kind of amnion of pure pleasure and so recharge yourself for the following year. It's never been my experience with vacations, that's for sure.
I really like the way you write about a pleasure and how difficult it can be to really achieve. You write about pleasure in The Infinite Jest, your latest novel. And I'm thinking, you know, one of the things relating to that in Infinite Jest, one of the characters finds that marijuana is no longer a pleasurable experience. It just makes him terribly self-conscious and therefore anxious. And I'm wondering what happens to you when you do something that's supposed to give you pleasure and that just makes you uncomfortable or anxious.
Boy, I'm not really even sure how to respond to that. I think, look, a lot of the impetus for writing Infinite Jest was just the fact that that I was about 30 and I had a lot of friends who were about 30 and we'd all, you know, been grotesquely overeducated and privileged our whole lives and had better health care and more money than our parents did. And we were all extraordinarily sad. And I think it has something to do with being raised in an era when really the ultimate value seems to be, I mean, a successful life is, let's see, you make a lot of money and you have a really attractive spouse or you get infamous or famous in some way. So that it's a life where you basically experience as much pleasure as possible, which ends up being sort of empty and low calorie. The reason I don't like talking about it discursively is it sounds very banal and cliche, you know, when you say it out loud that way. Believe it or not, this came as something of an epiphany to us at around age 30, sitting around talking about why on earth we were so miserable when we'd been so lucky.
Well, when did you realize that all the benefits you had in an educated middle-class life weren't bringing you happiness?
Well, I guess it sort of depends on what you mean by happiness. I mean, it's not like we were walking around fingering razor blades or anything like that, but it just sort of seems as if we sort of knew how happy our parents were, and we would compare our lives with our parents and see that at least on the surface or according to the criteria that the culture lays down for a successful, happy life, we were actually doing better than a lot of them were. And so why on earth were we so miserable? I don't mean to suggest that it was, you know, a state of constant clinical depression or that we all felt that we were supposed to be blissfully happy all the time. There was just I have a very weird and amateur sense that an enormous part of like my generation and the generation right after mine is just an extremely sad sort of lost generation, which when you think about the material comforts and the political freedoms that we enjoy is just strange.
In your novel Infinite Jest, you deal with the pursuit of entertainment and pleasure. In fact, Infinite Jest is the title of a movie within the novel. You want to tell us a little bit about that movie?
Well, the movie, I guess, is sort of the MacGuffin of the book. I guess the idea is a lot of the book is about a kind of art film director who eventually comes up with a film that's so entertaining that anybody who watches it never wants to do anything else. Then the interesting thing becomes, if such a thing exists, do you avail yourself of it or not? And various people wring their hands about various elements of that question, but that's part of what the book's about.
Do you think there are other new forms of pleasure that people pursue in the novel?
Well, I think, and it's not much of a coincidence, I think a lot of the people in the book are at about, you know, the situation that I was in when I was starting to work on the book, which were people who not only were vaguely unhappy in certain ways, but they sensed a kind of incongruity about why they were unhappy and were beginning to wonder what values and assumptions were leading them to be unhappy, and then facing the rather unpleasant fact that there's very little to replace those in this culture, if that makes any sense at all.
What are those that you're referring to?
Well, I guess the basic idea that I feel lame saying it out loud. I mean, it sounds like I'm Bill Bennett or something. I guess the basic idea that the purpose of life is to be happy, or is to experience the most favorable ratio of pleasure to suffering, or productivity to work, mm-hmm. or gratification to sacrifice, or any of that stuff. which, you know, a couple generations ago, to say that kind of stuff would have made you, you know, a freak and an Epicurean, and now seems to be so much simply an unquestioned assumption of the culture that we don't really even talk about it anymore. I'm certainly starting to perspire talking about it here because I'm afraid it sounds very, you know, it sounds like I'm going to walk out of the room with my knuckles dragging on the ground.
One of your essays in your new collection is about irony and how it's become the common language of TV and a lot of contemporary fiction. You talk about how television has institutionalized hip irony. Can I ask you to explain what you mean by that?
What sort of time limit is there? No, I mean, the essay is really about the relation between TV and fiction and what it's like to be a fiction writer who watches a lot of TV. And I guess the basic point is that a lot of the tools that were used by literary fiction writers in, I guess, particularly the 60s to help, oh, if there was a social agenda, I think it was probably to debunk certain kind of hypocritical, word-cleaverish assumptions that the culture was making about itself. Those techniques, including meta-discursive stuff, self-reference, irony, black humor, cynicism, grotesquerie, and shock. That what's interesting now is that really television, I think it would be safe to say that television or televisual values rule the culture. Television is now successfully using a lot of those same techniques, but using them for a very, very different agenda, which is to sort of create an ethos and please people and to sell products to consumers. So that the essay is supposed to be a setup for sort of what is the literary rebel or the writer who wants to be engaged somehow with the culture do now? You know, how do you be a rebel when Burger King, you know, for 2 years their slogan was, you got to break the rules. How do you rebel against anarchy or a kind of weird crafted anarchy?
David Foster Wallace is my guest, and his new collection of essays is called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. And his novel Infinite Jest has just been published in paperback. David, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This
Happy
is Fresh
to do
Air.
It.
Back with David Foster Wallace, author of the novel Infinite Jest and a new collection of essays called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. You write about how irony can become not only tiresome, but even tyrannical. What are some of the problems you see with the ironic voice, whether you're a viewer watching television or a writer using it in your fiction or essays?
Well, a vivid example to use right now is how I feel in here answering some of the questions you were asking about pleasure. The beads of perspiration I get on my forehead talking about something like, does my generation face a task in terms of exploring what values we want to live our lives by, or what we think the purpose of our life is, and how much is pleasure a part of it? I'm so terrified of sounding like Bill Bennett or, you know, Church Lady, who's been parodied on Saturday Night Live, or, God forbid, Stuart Smalley, who's been parodied on Saturday Night Live, that this entire how to talk straight about anything that really means anything, that might sound cliche, that might sound uncool, might sound unhip, I mean, there's an absolute terror that goes along with it. And I know, because most of my friends are my age and younger, that this is not just me, that there is some weird way that if the greatest sin in the past was, you know, obscenity or shock, the greatest sin now is appearing naive or old-fashioned so that somebody can give you a sort of a very cool arch smile and devastate you with one extraordinarily crafted line that puts kind of a hole in your pretentious balloon.
Now, is that a problem for you as a writer? Do you feel that there are certain sentiments, certain like heartfelt sentiments that you're afraid to deal with because it might sound square and corny?
Well, it's more complicated than that because usually if you're writing fiction, you're dealing with characters who themselves will have heartfelt sentiments, but who themselves live in this culture right now and thus face all the impediments to sort of dealing with those parts of their lives that, you know, that we do. So it would be not only silly but unrealistic to have a character saying that kind of stuff. I don't know. I mean, other writers with whom I talk about this stuff, it's more just this. A lot of writers are tired of doing kind of hip, slick, funny, dark, exploding hypocrisy, underlining once again the point that life is a farce and we're all in it for ourselves, and that the point of life is to amass as much money slash fame slash sexual gratification, you know, whatever your personal thing is, and that everything else is just glitter or PR image, that we're tired of sort of doing that stuff over and over and over again. Yet to do stuff that flies in the face of that is to risk becoming the Bridges of Madison County guy.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
a lot of the stuff
that would seem on the surface of it to counteract that is gooey, hideous, horrible, retrograde, cynical stuff, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, well, I think it's just like very perceptive of you to put your finger on the limitations of, like, the need for irony, but at the same time, the limitations of irony.
Irony, as far as I could see, and you know, you can take college courses for 3 years on just what irony is. So there's something. I guess I'm going to assume that everybody kind of knows. When David Letterman comes out and draws himself up to his full height and says, "What a fine crowd," you know, echoing the Arthur Godfrey of decades past. That's the kind of thing that I mean. Irony and sarcasm and all that stuff are fantastic for exploding hypocrisy and exposing what's wrong in extant values. As far as I can see, they're notably less good at erecting replacement values or coming any closer to the truth. And the thing about it is they're a terrific tool and they were used really well. We're just still using it, it seems to me, as a culture 35, 40 years after it really had some use.
Did you watch a lot of TV now?
I actually do not own a TV now, but that is not
wow.
TV's fault. It's my fault, because if I own it, I will watch it. And, you know, neighbors will find me by the smell 2 months later because I won't have left the house. So it's a very sad story.
It's kind of like TV Watchers Anonymous.
I have agreements with certain friends where if I want to watch a show, I will go over to their house to watch the show.
Well, what is so dangerous about television to you that you can't even have it around?
I don't know. I know that what I thought was my parents being mean when I was a little kid, it turned out to be, as usual, the older I get, the smarter they get. I will simply sit a foot away from the screen and watch it, even when after an hour or so I'm not even enjoying watching it because I'm feeling guilty at how non-productive I'm being, except the feeling guilty then makes me anxious, which I want to soothe by distracting myself, so I'll watch the TV even more, and it just gets... I don't know. It just gets depressing. My own relationship to TV depresses me. It's not TV per se. I do have a VCR, so it's not like I never watch a cathode ray screen.
Right, but you could rent movies for your
This
VCR.
Is true.
Right. So when did you start realizing that in order to not watch TV, you couldn't even own a TV?
When I was sick in bed one day and decided I would amuse myself by drawing up a list of all the things I thought would be neat to read or that I should have read and that I had not read. And by the time I was on the like 12th page, I began to panic and to realize that I needed to start doing some reading, and that if there was a TV in the room, I found out about a month later, the game I'll play with myself is, I'll read it with the TV on, which is just a farce. So I just decided I had too much to read to be able to own a TV.
Something else you write about really well is self-consciousness. And you write, for instance, about how writers are often bystanders, almost like voyeurs, and they're really good at watching other people, but they hate to be watched themselves and tend to be very self-conscious. Now, I know you don't want to overgeneralize, and this isn't true of all writers, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, I'm happy to overgeneralize. So
it's certainly true of a lot of writers.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I've said this before on Fresh Air, I think self-conscious narrators make the best narrators because they're self-conscious about every detail, every action they're making, and they're registering
yep.
everybody else's action.
I do. I think there's a certain kind of neurological makeup that goes along with being a writer, and having been in the room with a few other writers at the same time, it's rather wearing to be around. And it does, there is a kind of hypervigilance about it. Unfortunately, it's got disadvantages. If you turn that hypervigilance on yourself, and for instance, you know, whether or not you have a pimple on the end of your nose, I mean, it can get really depressing. It's also something of a continuum, and self-consciousness up to a point is really useful and really helpful, but I don't know how many people want to read a thing, you know, about self-consciousness of self-consciousness or self-consciousness of that, and it you can really kind of get in this infalling trap.
One of the characters in Infinite Jest is a tennis player, and you were a champion tennis player when you were.
I was not. I deny.
Okay, not
I deny
champion.
Steadfastly that I was a champion. I played competitive tennis on a regional junior level.
I
was not a champion, and I don't want anybody from my hometown to hear me profess the word champion.
You were a darned good tennis player.
I was decent by competitive standards.
Okay, good. And this is when you were about, what, age 12 to 15?
Something like that, yeah.
Now, did all your self-consciousness interfere with your performance on the court?
This is a marvelous setup. Well, of course. I mean, this is one of the great mysteries about athletes and why I think they appear dumb to some of us is that they seem to have this ability to turn off. I don't know how many of your listeners have this part in their brain, but what if I double fault on this point? Or what if I miss this free throw? Or what if I don't get this strike with the entire bowling team, you know, hanging on? The professional athletes and great athletes, at first I thought it was that stuff doesn't occur to them. But when I hung out with the pro tennis player for the tennis essay, it occurred to me that it's more like they have some sort of muscle that can cut that kind of thinking off. But that is literally paralyzing. You can end up like a bunny, you know, in the headlights of an oncoming car if you do that to yourself enough.
Did you have that ability to turn it off?
No. And I was a middlingly talented athlete, but my big problem, and the coach told me at age 13, kid, you got a bad head. And what he meant was I would choke. I would begin thinking about, oh, no, what if this happens? And then I would say, well, shut up, don't think about it. And then I would say to myself, but how can I not think about it if I'm not thinking about it? And meanwhile, you know, I'm standing drooling on the baseline going through this whole not very interesting game of mental ping pong while the other guy is briskly going about the business of winning the match.
See, but you were a philosophy major in college, right?
That is correct.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there's a certain kind of philosophy and a certain kind of spontaneity that don't mix.
This is true. Philosophy majors did not have really vivid social lives at my college.
But, you know, and philosophy is so much about just thinking about and analyzing and critically seeing every action and every thought, which is the opposite of what you're talking about you need to do as an athlete.
Well, there are a lot of different kinds of philosophy, and most of the philosophy that we study in America is analytic, which is far more hard-headed Yankee ingenuity thing. The existentialists really get into the, you know, what is the word about and stuff like that. But it's also true that it's a meta-discipline that involves stepping back a dimension or getting up a level above something else and picking apart its axioms. And it's really neat up to a certain point. And then you can sit in a chair staring straight ahead with your lower lip trembling for really long periods of time.
Yeah.
I had a bad head for that too.
David Foster Wallace, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you back.
David Foster Wallace has a new collection of essays called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. His novel Infinite Jest has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
If they could see me now, that little gang of mine, I'm eating fancy chow and drinking fancy wine. I'd like those Stumbo bums to see for a fact the kind of top drawer, first rate chums I attract. All I can say is, wowee, look at where I am. Tonight I landed, pow, right in a pot of jam. What a setup, holy cow. They'd never believe it if my friends could see me now. If they...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz looks at a tribute to the nice work of Ira Gershwin coming up on PBS. Also, diapers, temp work, and the downside of love. Songwriter Amy Rigby sings about being dragged kicking and screaming into adulthood while refusing to give up music. We'll talk about her CD, Diary of a Mod Housewife. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Singer-songwriter Amy Rigby says she's been a mod housewife ever since 1993, when she decided she was not going to get down on her hands and knees and scrub the bathroom floor unless she could get up on stage and sing about it. She didn't want to fight about sex and laundry with her husband unless she could turn it into a song. Amy Rigby describes her CD, Diary of a Mod Housewife, as a collection of songs she wrote as an accompaniment to daily life. The CD was on the top 10 list of the Village Voice annual end-of-the-year critics poll. Before going out on her own, Rigby performed in the postmodern girl group The Shams and the cowpunk group Last Roundup. We'll meet Amy Rigby after we hear her song, We're Stronger Than That.
When we made our vows to heaven hold, we never thought about how love grows old. Well, even healthy trees run out of sap. Baby, we're stronger than that. And when I look at you, I see too much. I try to walk away when things get rough. But every time I do, I come right back. 'Cause baby, we're stronger than that. We're stronger than the fairy tales, diaper pails, lack of heat, urge to cheat, shattered hopes, tired jokes, doctor bills, urge to kill. And when we have another argument.
Amy Rigby, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
The song that we just played, We're Stronger Than That, I think that's a really good song. Not a lot of rock songs I can think of have the word diaper pails in it. Are these songs different from the songs that you sang with earlier bands that you performed with?
Yeah, in that they have more references to kind of humdrum, real life things as opposed to fantasy or... the glamour of being, like in The Shams, it was a little more glamorous, I guess, being a young woman on the go. Yeah, there's more specifics, I guess, in the songs on my album.
In your liner notes, you say that your favorite subjects like making a living, having a family, and trying to keep a sense of humor through all of that aren't really popular subjects in the bohemian ghetto where you had performed. Had you tried singing about subjects like this?
Well, actually, The Shams used to do a song in the set that I didn't write, but that was called 3 a.m., and it was about, it's only sort of 3 a.m., the baby's waking up again. And people really responded to that song. But in the rock world, it's not sexy to be over 30 and be talking about things like that. And it's kind of like it's better to pretend that that doesn't exist, because it might turn off the 18-year-old boys that buy records. So,
do you feel like you had a breakthrough as a songwriter in trying to write songs that actually reflected real life for you?
Well, I've always tried to do that, but I think it probably reached a point in my life and in my writing ability where, and also a feeling of freedom, of not needing to get an okay from other band members, where I really could just write in my own voice. And so all the elements came together and I was able to do it just without any fear or worries about what the outcome was going to be, just feeling free to express something.
Let me get in another song here, and this is a song called Knapsack. And this isn't exactly a song about, living in a committed relationship or being a mother. It's a song about having a crush on someone who works in a bookstore. Is there a story behind the song?
Well, I do a lot of temp work in New York City, and I'm sent to different offices in different neighborhoods, and I happen to be in a new neighborhood, and I always stake out where's the bookstore. And so the bookstore, I started going in there at lunchtime and noticing that there was a bag check guy there. And so, yeah, it was just a little fantasy I had about him. And then, I mean, it's just like it says in the song, and then I had to leave the job, and I'd never spoken to him, but he just seeing him every day kind of gave me a little lift.
Okay, this is Amy Rigby from her album Diary of a Mod Housewife, and this is Knapsack.
He took my knapsack just inside the revolving door. It was a bookstore where I'd never been before. Wasn't looking for anything more than a book, but I looked, isn't that what eyes are for? Studied biographies, I checked out the magazines. My mind kept leading me back to his face. I'd seen something about him, made me feel 17. Stop. So I'm not, isn't that what minds are for? Now every day I can't wait to see him. I'm gonna ask his name. But every day I hand him my bag and everything remains the same.
It's Amy Rigby from her CD Diary of a Mod Housewife. Now, you were telling us that you wrote this because you're a temp and you're always getting moved to different neighborhoods. What kind of temporary work do you do?
Like administrative assistant, answering phones, word processing, and, shuffling papers from one desk to another, that type of thing.
Since you do so much temp work, do you ever have trouble showing up for your own gigs at night? And here's the reason why I ask. So many rock concerts start at, 10 in the evening, and it's as if they just assume that no one in their audience could possibly have to go to work the next day. And I'm talking about weekday night concerts. How do you show up for your own dates and then go to work the next day?
Well, it's kind of like being a parent in a way, in that you just find the energy somewhere to keep going. And for financial reasons, if I have to work, I've got to do that. But nothing is going to stop me from going and playing a show. I don't care if I don't eat. I don't care if I don't sleep. I don't care if I get to see Seinfeld or not. I'll just do it because I have to. And I can't wait to get up and play, so whatever it takes. And I'm a very good temp, like I don't need any of my mental I don't need much of my brain to answer somebody's phone or type their letter. It's almost, unfortunately, it becomes almost relaxing in a way to do somebody else's work. And there's like a little trap there, because sometimes, I feel myself feeling very comfortable going into a temp job.
My guest is Amy Rigby. Her new CD is called Diary of a Mod Housewife. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with singer-songwriter Amy Rigby. Let's hear another song from your CD, Diary of a Mod Housewife. And you've described this CD as almost being a journal of a couple of years in your life. The song we're going to hear is called Downside of Love. What was happening in your life when you wrote this song about the downside of love? about things that you feel when the relationship is in the downswing side.
Well, I guess it just seemed so mysterious to me, like, why, when your friends get married and everyone's always so excited and hopeful and so, like, they're all there at your side when you're getting together with this other person. But when things aren't going so well, it's like you're not allowed to talk about it. And I found that, I mean, I'm a blabbermouth. I like to talk about what's going on in my life, and I found it to be very lonely to want someone to tell me how to do things better or something, and just kind of feeling like it wasn't okay to really talk about it with other people. I mean, you know, there's always the sessions with a couple female friends where you sit around and complain, but in general, it feels really kind of lonesome, and that was what inspired me to write this song.
I think it's a really good song. Why don't we hear it? This is Amy Rigby.
We get a little morose, been a little too close to the downside of love. See what can happen to friends. Generosity ends on the downside of love.
That's Amy Rigby, The Downside of Love, from her CD Diary of a Mod Housewife. Amy, tell me about the bands you were in before, and what your persona was like in those bands, what you were like on stage, what kind of songs you sang.
Well, my first band, Last Roundup, I was really pretty shy. I was the rhythm guitar player in the gingham dress, you know, kind of in the back of the stage, singing some harmonies when I could work up the nerve to do that. But writing
songs. And this was what, a country type of band?
Yeah.
An urban country band?
Yeah, kind of like a honky-tonk band, no drums. Kind of sounded a little like the Hank Williams records.
Mm-hmm.
But I found myself just inspired to write songs, so it was good for me. It was like I was making music, but I wasn't having to put myself like too much out there, and then the Shams, then I had a baby and started, you know, feeling a little less shy, and the Shams started playing, and we were three women friends who loved to sing together, and most of our time was spent just hanging around a kitchen table laughing and talking, and every now and then we'd rehearse a little bit, and that, you know, that's kind of what we carried onto the stage with us, was just kind of our camaraderie. And so, and the songs that I was writing then were just kind of inspired by the sound of our voices and the things that we could do arrangement-wise. And so there I was taking a little more of a leadership role. I was feeling a little more comfortable or compelled to do that.
A lot of your songs are autobiographical, and many of the songs on your new CD are about, well, as you put it, the downside of love, the downside of a relationship. and your marriage broke up toward the end of the production of this record. I'm wondering how if you don't mind my asking, how your ex felt about these, you know, pretty personal songs that one could assume involved him in some way. You know, one could assume it was about your relationship with him.
Well, you know, in retrospect, I feel like I was really pretty selfish about it. It never occurred to me when I started performing these songs in public how much they might hurt him, or because I guess I thought that they're songs, they're not real life. They're songs, and so. But I think, you know, now I'm aware that it can be really painful to, you know, it was my choice to get up on stage and sing about what was going on in my life, but it wasn't his choice for me to do that. So, you know, I think that it's was pretty painful. But I don't know, it just felt necessary to me. But, you know, I probably wouldn't try to save a relationship that way again. I don't think it worked, you know, as far as that goes.
Do you feel like you were trying to save the relationship through the songs you were writing?
I think that I had such a hard time speaking directly in my relationship, and then I found, oh gosh, you know, when I put it in a song, it kind of, like, everyone can really understand what I'm saying, you know, everyone being, you know, an audience, but, you know, and I guess I thought that would apply to him as well, but I don't think, you know, that it really worked that way.
Is there a particular song you're thinking of where you felt like there were things you could say in a song that you had trouble saying and being understood about if you said it in person, in life?
I guess, well, for example, Don't Look at Me in That Tone of Voice. I mean, it's kind of a humorous song. But I guess I sort of, I meant it when I said it in the song that I felt like we never really talked, but now in retrospect and I think I've understood this really because a lot of you know, men don't feel put off by my record, like they're being put they're being bashed. I feel like I was kind of just as guilty of not talking. So, you know, it's kind of all the songs kind of, when I look at them and think I was saying, you know, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Now when I look at them and the words and stuff, I can see that I was talking to myself just as much as to him. So, you know, I've learned a lot.
Well, Amy Rigby, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Amy Rigby's CD is called Diary of a Mod Housewife. This Sunday she performs in Boston, and next week she'll be at the South by Southwest Music Conference in Austin, Texas. Here's her song, That Tone of Voice.
You're telling me you're wise to my tricks. Without opening your mouth, you're saying to get out and be quick.
Coming up, a tribute to Ira Gershwin. This is Fresh Air. December 6, 1996, marked the 100th birthday of the other Gershwin, George's older brother and closest collaborator, Ira. That night, Carnegie Hall presented a gala tribute to Ira. This Friday, many PBS stations will broadcast a 90-minute version of that concert. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz was there and has these thoughts.
Some of this country's best poets have been the song lyricists whose lively language, fresh imagery, and what Ira Gershwin called fascinating rhythm capture certain aspects of American life that more strictly literary poets don't often deal with, from personal relationships to politics. "Who cares what banks fail in Yonkers," Ira wrote during the Depression, "long as you've got the kiss that conquers." "Of thee I sing, baby," begins the cheeky title song of the 1931 political satire for which Ira became the first lyricist to win the Pulitzer Prize. He launches the preeminent American opera, Porgy and Bess, with the evocative "Summertime and the livin' is easy. Fish are jumpin' and the cotton is high." Then later tells us, "It ain't necessarily so." The witty contraction, "swonderful," swings into the verse with the exhilaration of colloquial American English at its most colorful. Don't trust anyone who sings, "It's wonderful." I wouldn't trust anyone who changes any of Ira's words. What foolish political correctness made Karen Akers, one of the most sensitive singers in the long lineup of stars and semi-stars at Carnegie Hall, change the line in "But Not For Me" from "It all began so well, but what an end. This is the time a feller needs a friend," to the clunky "This is the time a person needs a friend"? Didn't she hear the rhyme of "well" and "fella"? Didn't she get the irony of Ira's gender bending?
"It all began so well, but what an end. This is the time a person needs a friend. When every happy thought ends with the marriage knot, and there's no knot for me."
This Ira Gershwin Gala is one of those formula enterprises. You know, the over-orchestrated overture, the generic announcer who introduces the movie star co-hosts as Mr. Michael York and Miss Angie Dickinson, the production numbers with ballet dancing that has nothing to do with the songs, and the hosts reading from a script that has barely enough facts to be informative and barely enough anecdotes to be entertaining.
Dear Ira was the least critical person around, but he was a classicist, and he would correct your grammar. Once I said to him, "I feel so badly you lost." And Ira said, "Would you feel goodly if I had won?" I never said it wrongly again.
At Carnegie Hall, I saw some marvelous Gershwin home movies, but many of them have been edited out of the TV version. Along with Michael York's recitation of Gershwin lyrics, and the late composer Burton Lane's reminiscences of his collaboration with Ira. Lane died only a few weeks afterwards. It's too bad all that's left of him in the TV version is his effervescent accompaniment to the smarmy preening of Michael Feinstein, one of those singers who gives the term song stylist such a bad name. Lane's presence, though, is an important reminder that after George Gershwin's untimely death, his brother worked brilliantly with other composers, like Jerome Kern, Harold Arlen, Vincent Eumanns, Kurt Weill, even Aaron Copland. The performer who most lives up to the material is Rosemary Clooney, who lived next door to the Gershwins and may be our greatest living interpreter of classic popular songs. She sings a couple of the best ones ever written, including Love Is Here to Stay, the opening verse to which George Gershwin didn't live to write. Clooney tells us that it's the only music ever composed by Ira himself.
The more I read the papers, the less I comprehend the world and all its capers and how it all will end. Nothing seems to be lasting, but that isn't our affair. We've got something permanent, I mean, in the way we care. It's very clear. Our love is here to stay, not for a year, but ever and a day. The radio and the telephone and the movies that we know may just be passing fancies, and in time may go.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Ira Gershwin at 100, which will air on many PBS stations Friday. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Joan Tui Westman. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.